Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and today we're having a PaleoCast first. We've covered animals before, we've covered plants before, but never ever fungi. So we'll be discussing an entirely new kingdom to the show, and given the importance of fungi, it's quite a travesty that it's taken us this long to get to them. In this episode, recorded with Professor Marc-André Salos of the Natural History Museum in Paris, we're told of the importance of the symbiotic relationship between plants and fungi, and the role that this may have played in the colonization of land. But first, as many of you may have noticed, we're temporarily without a website after we got hacked. So it'll take a little while to undo the damage done and get things up and running again. So, if you care about the well-being of the show, this would be a very good opportunity to send in any donations, and they'd all be very much appreciated. So, with our website AWOL, we're posting up all of our usual images, diagrams, and the download link on Facebook. If you don't want to download, and perhaps you don't have much room on your hard drive, then you can listen in your browser by visiting our YouTube channel, where we're now uploading audio. Anyway, this is a fantastic episode and I personally learnt a lot. Marc-André was a real fun guy to interview, so I hope you'll all be liking it. Marc-André, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Could you tell us about your path into academia, please?
Oh, well, I'm rather a mycologist and botanist. I was training at École Normale Supérieure in Paris. And then I thought that I would like to be a forest engineer. So I went to a forestry school, but later, I shifted back to a thesis, and I made my thesis in 98 in Paris again. And finally, I'm now fully academic since then.
And you're a professor at the Natural History Museum in Paris, is that right?
Yes, I'm professor at the Natural History Museum in Paris, and I am also professor at Viçosa University in Brazil and Gdańsk University in Poland.
And how is the Natural History Museum in Paris with all the floods? Have you been having any issues?
Yeah, these days it's a bit scary because the Seine River is raising and raising, and we are very close to the river. So we try to protect a bit of our collections, like every of the museums around the Seine River. But the museum is more than simply a museum. It's, of course, made of exhibition, but we also carry out teaching and research like any other university, and even during flooding.
So you're not ankle deep in water? Are you still pretty dry?
So far, yes.
Right, good. I hope it stays that way. Can you tell us how you got interested in fungi?
The story tells us a lot about the importance of teaching and the importance of teachers. When I was very young, I was, I think, something like 13-year-old, our biology teacher told us, for next week, just bring fungi from the forest for us to start a bit of discussion about this group of organisms. And, I stayed stuck to this order. I'm still collecting mushrooms since then. I just realized that it was fascinating to pick them up, and I spent all my weekends from there trying to give names and so on. I was fascinated by fungi. And later, when I decided to find a job, it was quite obvious that I would have to do research on fungi, but taxonomy looked a bit boring to me, and I decided to go into more functional issues. But that's a personal, you know, view of it. We need taxonomy, and I done it over 10 years as a child.
So you are a myctologist, not a paleo myctologist, right?
No, I'm not paleo. But to be honest, I think that when you have interest in a group or in a mechanism, you have to look in the past. What you observe is part of a process which is ongoing. So there is a future, it's changing now, but it's also the result of past changes, and you have to take that into account.
Today we'll be discussing the link between plants and fungi and the role that that relationship played in terrestrialization. But first, we need a quick introduction to the two groups, really. So what are the main differences between plants and fungi?
Well, plants, in a broad sense, are photosynthetic organisms. They have a plastid. Oh, by the way, they got this plastid just by harvesting a unicell that was able to carry out photosynthesis, and that happened many times in evolution. So it's polyphyletic. But plants, they are photosynthetic, and we can break them down into aquatic plants. I suggest that we call them algae today. And the land plants, which are living on land, and I suggest we call them plants simply today. So they are they can live in different environments, okay, but they are autotrophic. Fungi belong to those eukaryotes that are not autotrophic; they are heterotrophic and have to find their food in the environment already prepared. So they can live as parasites, as symbionts, or living on decaying dead material as saprobes. And the fungi, they are very often filamentous. I mean, there are some exceptions. Some are secondarily unicellulars, like yeasts. But there are filamentous organisms that are heterotrophic.
And do we find them in aquatic environments as well?
Oh, yes, yes. And the most basal, the most early diverging groups are still aquatic, meaning that, well, they are probably emerged from the water. But they are biphyletic, because this habit I described to you arose twice. One group encompasses the most of the fungi we know, ascomycetes, basidiomycetes, the one you eat. For example, they are in the eumycetes, in its most of the species. But there is a small group, mainly parasites, the oomycetes, for example, causing agents of the mildew diseases, for example, like Plasmopara or Phytophthora, which belongs to the oomycetes, and they have totally different origin in evolution, but we won't, I think, today discuss much of this later.
How distantly related are plants from fungi? I mean, we have them together in the vegetable aisle at the supermarket. Are they pretty similar, or are they completely different groups?
Well, yeah. The market is not the best place to get trained with phylogeny. You're right to mention that. What I said is that plants and fungi, they arose many times, twice for fungi at least, and many times for plants, so in the large sense. So that's already something tricky. It's true that they don't move. And based on that, they were in the plant in a broad sense, and taught in botany in the broad sense in the past. What we know now is that this is totally unrelated, and to discuss the fungi as we will use them today, the eumycetes are closer to animals, to metazoans, than they are to plants. So really we can view them as distinct lineages.
So if we were to have a supermarket based on phylogeny, we should be putting the mushrooms closer to the meat than to the rest of the plants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's merchandising that needs to be fixed.
Well, if being professor doesn't work out for you, we can start our own supermarket. We appear to have many more plants than we do fungi. If we were to go for a walk in the forest, or for your example, when you were 13, walking around the forest trying to find mushrooms, you would have found loads and loads of plants, but only very few mushrooms. Is it the case that we have more plants than we do fungi, or do they just occupy different niches?
Well, if you go to the forest, as I was going as a child when I was picking mushrooms and trying to identify them, and if you really try to identify them, you will see that you have probably more fungal species than plant species, even in this forest. But you have to keep in mind that fungi are microscopic most of the time. They are microbes most of the time. They are made of microscopic filaments, as we said, the filaments that we call hyphae, and the hyphae are not conspicuous. And many fungi do not produce the conspicuous fruiting body you see in the forest. Most of them produce spores, but only some produce the spores on fruiting bodies. So most are microscopic. And if you go to this, there are many more species than you can even see. And the estimate for eumycetes is very debated. It's from 1 for the very, very lowest to 10 or even 30 million of species, whereas for plants, at least land plants, okay, it's something like 250,000. So really, they are much more frequent, and let me tell you a simple reason for that. Many fungi have a specific link to one plant species, and there are something like 2 to 10 different fungi that are specific to one plant species. Based on such calculation, you can make a ratio of what you expect in numbers of plants versus fungi. Yes, they are, however, diverse.
What is the relationship then of the plant to the fungi?
It's very variable. It can be that the fungi are simply living on plant remains after their death, like some, well, if you think of the button mushroom, the Paris mushroom, or call it as you want, this white mushroom you have on the market, it's growing on dead organic matter from plants. The link can be with living plants, and they can be parasites. For example, you often see on the leaves, living leaves, a whitish cover, powdery mildews, or an orange cover, or an orange color of the tissues, that's the rust fungi. So they are parasites. It's an interaction with the plant, living plant. Sometimes they kill it, but they take profit of it, and it's not good for the plant. And the last third way is symbiotic interaction. I think we'll discuss this more, but it's when they live on the plant, feed on the plant, but also provide some advantages to the host. So it's a reciprocally beneficial interaction that we call a mutualism. Or more exactly, since they live together in addition, it's a symbiosis.
Are these symbiotes obligate symbiotes? Like they have to work with each other, otherwise they both wouldn't be able to survive?
Depends on the species, but for most species, yes, even if it's overlocked. I often tell the story of those plants that are very easily growing in Europe, the pinus trees. Pinus are pioneer trees, they grow everywhere in Europe. But when the Europeans tried to introduce them in their colonies in Africa or in South America, where the pinus didn't grow, they wanted to do that because they grow fast and they make very nice maize for the ships. And at the time, you needed ships to reach the colonies. They were not growing there. They were simply going to death. And they had to bring soil from Europe, and by this way, they brought fungi, to allow the growth of those plants. So there was a hidden, obligatory relationship to fungi in pinus, which is not conspicuous in Europe because those fungi are everywhere, so they are not limiting. But when you export pinus to tropical regions, then they need the fungus. Now they have it because we introduced the fungi as well, and they are invasive there. But this is the group, this obligate symbiosis, which is invasive.
And what about things like lichens? What are those?
Okay, so I was mentioning how some of the big plants we have on land are depending on the fungus, but there are also some small algae that went on land. They are now terrestrial plants, of course, but they are Unicella or filamentous, and some of those, they need the fungus to grow. Some, not all. If you go to a group like Trentepolia, which is quite common in lichens, let me remember you that lichens, they have the shape of one organism, but they are made with hyphae of a fungus mixed with algae. And some of those algae are not necessarily mycorrhizal. I think, for example, of the big group of Trentepolia that can live also alone. Some other like Trebuchsia, another big group, are only or mostly found in lichens. So there is also some case of strict dependency on the algal side. And for the fungus, well, very often it's the same story. They need either the alga or the plant to grow. Oh, by the way, something funny is that all those autotrophic plants we find on land, they belong to only one of the many clades of photosynthetic algae or photosynthetic plants. They are all in the chlorobionta. They all belong to green plants, which went many times on land. And, well, each time, Trabuxia, Trentepolia, or the big long plant we have around us, they started interacting with fungi.
Well, we'll get onto that in a second. First, I just want to ask, are there any plants that don't have this symbiotic relationship?
You have some algae that can live alone. For example, on the bark, on the bark of the tree, sometimes you have a green cover, a green powder that is coloring your clothes if you scratch them. Those are chlorococcus, and they are not associated with fungi. And for vascular plants, there are some families like the crucifers, Brassicaceae, the family of cabbage, for example, or Polygonaceae or Moschenopodiaceae, that don't have fungal symbionts, as far as we know. So it happens, but it's rather the exception than the rule. Well, let's say 10% of the species don't have interaction with fungi. But they don't escape parasites. They have interaction with parasites, but they don't have mutualistic interaction with fungi.
Right, since we're going to be looking at the terrestrialization of these groups, it makes sense to let's just forget everything that we're familiar with on land and concentrate on what the earliest life was like in the sea. So when do we get the first fossil evidence of plants and the fungi?
Well, evidence of land plants, okay, of plants on land, it's something that is 470 million years ago. And before we have the algae, well, it's debated, but since the Precambrian, so autotrophic organisms in the sea, they are very ancient. For fungi, it's more complex because the fossils you can get, those are filaments. And filaments, they can be from bacteria as well. So the morphology doesn't tell us a lot. So I would say that they are probably very ancient. You could even find some record of aquatic fungi in the Precambrian as well. But I tend to have some doubts on this fungi, and many paleontologists, they tend to have that. But those are very ancient groups. And another way of knowing how ancient they are would be to use a molecular clock based on phylogenies and calibration of the divergence time of some groups. But here, the answer is a bit loose. But roughly, let's say that at 1 milliard years ago, so 1,000 million years ago, everyone was there already, for sure, and probably earliest, probably earlier.
And these are going to be pretty simple, single-celled sort of algae-type things, the plants.
Yeah, that time the algae. Well, it seems that something like 800 million years ago, you have some fossils which are macroscopic and multicellular, so multicellular algae. They probably arose quite early as well, but most of the algae were unicellular, as are now the algae you find in lichens, for example. And, well, probably the algae, the unicellular algae, they went very early on land. Let's be clear, before the extant big lung plant arose, there was life on land. But it was a crust, you know, crust of those were biofilms, to say technically. So the surface of the rocks was probably very sticky and slitty with a small crust of things, among which there were probably algae as producers and perhaps fungi and very probably bacteria as heterotrophic things. But it was a thin crust, nothing to do with extant ecosystems.
Well, before we get onto the land, I just want to work out what life is like in the ocean for plants and fungi. So what advantages does living in the sea convey?
Okay. Living in water is very convenient in a way because it's translucent, so you have the light coming, but you can also be at depth that avoid the UV rays that are absorbed by the water molecules, so you can be protected of excess light. You also have as solutes, you have nitrogen, phosphorus, iron, you have all the minerals you need, and of course you have water. Simply, when you are far from the continent, the products of erosion are not reaching you, so you may be a bit depleted in iron or phosphorus. But still, everything is around you. Light, mineral nutrients, water. This is very different from what we find on soil or on land, because there are two compartments. One is providing you the gas, oxygen, CO2, and the light, the atmospheric compartment. Another one, but quite different, is providing you mineral, and if everything is okay, because there is not a lot and it can be dry very soon, but water. So you have a two-compartment story. Plus, you are not protected from the UV rays. Well, to be honest, now we are rather protected by the ozone layer that was established very early. But at the beginning, it was not a very good place to live. Once ozone layer was available, there started to be those biofilms I mentioned to you covering the soil. But it took time to reach the vegetation and the land ecosystems as we know them now.
So how did these biofilms come about? What kind of innovations did plants and fungi have to come up with to be able to move from this marine ecosystem to this terrestrial one?
Oh, well, desiccation tolerance, that's rather sure. If you accept some specific place where there was permanently water, the problem was that most of the place, for example, when on the border of a trail or on the rocks today, there still exists such biofilms, okay? When it's raining, it's wet and they are living. When it's not raining, they wait. They dry and wait. So, yes, desiccation. And desiccation tolerance is, of course, limiting your complexity. Because if you rely on diverse organs, given that after drying some will not survive and start again the process, you cannot be dependent on very differentiated organs or structures. So it's limiting the complexity, and every cell has to be potentially the starting again of everything after a long drying. So their complexity was very limited. We have very few of those biofilms because, the fossilization of terrestrial environments is a very challenging thing, and those biofilms are very thin. But there are some evidence that late in the Precambrian you start having filaments of fungi or bacteria and bigger cells, likely from algae, in soils. In what was the kind of soils at that time, which is simply an interface between atmosphere and geosphere.
What was the role of symbiosis in the terrestrialization?
At this type of biofilm, I don't know, and I'm not sure anyone could answer. And then later, it started, some multicellular big organisms started to colonize the land ecosystems. Those were the first land plants, the first plants as we know them today, and they are much bigger. And at the time, there was a fungus. They likely were associated with a fungus in their roots. We have, let's say, two evidence for this. First evidence is that nowadays, in most ecosystems and in most plant lineages, with a few exceptions that we mentioned earlier, the roots of the plants associate with fungi. What you call a root when you unearth a root system, what you call a root is very often colonized by fungi. Most of the time, there are fungi around it, and you can see that with a good lens, or even there is fungus simply in the root, which you need to see under the microscope. So, if you look at the phylogenetic distribution of that, it also exists in Marchantiophyta or in Antoceratophyta. So, if you look at the phylogenetic distribution of that, the most parsimonious explanation is that the common ancestor of land plants had it. That's the first thing. Second thing is that we also have some fossil, and we may come back to this, that shows that as early as we can investigate tissues, we can find plant in those tissues. Well, so this discussion is on the multicellular land plants. For lichens, when did they appear? It seems that we can have some Silurian lichens. There are good works by Jan Edwards and Rosemary Honegger that show that we have very early lichens, but they are about at the same time as the multicellular land plants, making that at some point we start having bigger things, land plants and lichens, and they rely on symbiosis with the fungus.
So we've got biofilms, we've got the larger plant and fungi symbiotes, we got the lichens. Did these larger phytotrophs evolve from the biofilms, or did they each have their own terrestrialization event?
It's a complex question. Even the level at which land plants are issuing from big multicellular aquatic ancestors is, in my knowledge, not so clear. So I would say that there are two models. Either they evolved within the biofilms, or something went out of water. Well, at least when you look at the closest relatives of the phototrophic organisms that are living nowadays on land, they are in fresh water. And you know, fresh water is a good predisposition for going to the land plant, to land, because it's undergoing frequent desiccation. It's not as stably watered as oceans are. So it probably occurred from fresh water, at least on the phototrophs, on the photosynthetic side. And second thing is that it probably arose many times. One time, for the multicellular land plant we know, but many, many times for the algae that you can find now in lichens. That's the view we have of it.
If we look at the fossil record now, when do we get the first direct evidence of symbiosis? Do we have fossils that have the photosynthetic plants and like the filamentous fungi structures?
Well, so the first evidence of lichens as we know them today, it's the Lower Devonian and Late Silurian period. Some very nice lichens, very equivalent to those we have today, were described as charcoalified fossils from the Lower Devonian. And they look quite like extant lichens. There are in the late Silurian some other lichens that are a bit different in shape, but clearly involve a fungus and algae. Oh, by the way, in this case, those are cyanobacteria, but still, those are autotrophic organisms. So that's quite late, because at that time, we know that since 460 million of years, we already have land plants, multicellular land plants. And for those, the earliest evidence of symbiosis is from the well-preserved rhynid shirt flora, which is around 407 million years. So it's a bit late, but let me explain that. Most of the fossil we get are usually compressions. Due to the accumulation of rocks above the fossils, they become flat. Well, the problem to investigate the presence of fungus in tissues is that you need a good three-dimensional preservation. And the rhinid shirt is from an ecosystem a bit like Yellowstone, where there were hot springs. And sometimes there was a flooding, and at that time, you suddenly were transforming the vegetation around, which was 10 to 30 centimeter high, into a rock, a siliceous rock. That's the first thing, fast preservation. The second thing was that this was never buried under tons of sediments. So it stayed in shape. So when you make a thin section of the rock, you can, under the microscope, simply see the plant remains, or even sometimes from the eye. That's wonderfully preserved. And there we find exactly the same shape of interaction of the fungus and the organs of the plants, which at that time were not roots. Roots evolved later. Probably they evolved to harvest more fungus from the soil, by the way. But, well, let's keep on those plants. They had rhizomes, and those rhizomes are filled with hyphae from fungi. And those hyphae, they are making some thickenings, which are called vesicules, exactly as in non-plants currently, where the fungus is storing its own reserves. And they also penetrate sometimes in some cells, making a ramification that we call arbuscule. Those arbuscules are the place where the plant and the fungus are exchanging food. The plant is giving sugar to the fungus. The fungus is giving mineral nutrients it collected in the soil to the plant. So we have exactly the same features, and the tissues show evidence that they were alive at that time. That's even more impressive, that we have evidence that it was living association, not a fungus in dead things, or not a parasite. Because the cells have very thin wall, and they are round. If they are round, it means that they were under pressure at time of fossilization, that they were living. Such a cell, if they are dead, they start to be not round anymore and to have a shape that depends on what is around, because the cell wall is too thin to maintain the shape without the pressure of water, what we call turgescence. So, to make it short, we don't know the exchange between the partners, but we have exactly the same shape of interaction as we have in current land plants.
And that amount of detail is preserved in the rhinid shirt.
Oh, the rhinid shirt is a dream. In some fungi from the rhinid shirt, you even have the flagella of the spermatozoids in some cysts. Can you believe that? So it means that there is fast preservation plus no compression or no squeezing of the samples. And we have a window on the diversity of this ecosystem, which is overgrown. I was just mentioning another lichen that I said is a bit different from extant one. It's a wonderful lichen made of hyphae that are making baskets, okay, a kind of stroma of hyphae making baskets, and in the baskets you have clearly cyanobacteria that are dividing, and few hyphae are going in the baskets, probably to interact with the cyanobacteria. So it's a lichen in terms of its a very integrated structure, mixing fungus and algae in a broad sense, but it's a different shape of the extant lichens, where the fungus and the algae are much more mixed together in the middle layer of the lichen. So yes, the rhinid shirt is wonderful, even for zoologists, you know.
Oh, definitely. It's something that we're going to have to cover on this show in the future. Especially for me as someone who researches chelicerates, like little things like trigonotarbids and mites and stuff that you get there. It's such wonderful preservation, and it's one of the Lagerstätter that really has stuck in my head ever since I was an undergraduate. It's absolutely beautiful. It's interesting that the first evidence is in charcoal, though. We spoke about we spoke about this in episode 22 with Professor Andrew Scott about the level of detail that you can get in charcoal. But the interesting thing for me is, was there enough of a coverage of lichen at the time that it could burn if you've got lichen preserved as charcoal, then something around it must have been burning. Was it just pure density of lichen?
Well, keep in mind that those earliest lichens are 415 million years old, so it's after the first land plants arose.
Ah.
We don't know them, because we have no fossil for them. We only have for them the meiotic spores. So we have no direct fossil evidence, with a few exceptions of things that were studied by Jan Edwards and that look like creeping Marcantiofita or something like that. But we have few evidence for them, but we find tons of meiotic spores. So the fossilization is not good over this period, and that's why the first place where we can investigate in more detail the things is the Rhynie chert, by the way, 400 million years ago. But for sure, as soon as they arose on land, two things arose, or two things emerged. First, there was more biomass on land. Biomass of plants, but also on lichens, because at the same time, they were arising. And second, there was more photosynthesis. Because first, bigger things were carrying out photosynthesis on land, but since they were contributing to weathering, they were pushing more nutrients in the water. So you have more oxygen. And that's the point where you start to have sufficient oxygen. The Silurian is the very beginning of that, to have fires. On land ecosystems with simply biofilms, you don't have fire. I mean, can you imagine a fire on a wall covered with algae? If you start to have pure organic matter, you know, going out of the soil, like those big, thicker lichens as compared to the biofilms, or those first land plants that were 10 to 20 centimeters high, well, in some conditions of dryness, it can burn. And then if it burns, the charcoalified tissues, they will not decay anymore. They will keep their shape. And I share your fascination with that, because it's also some of the rare case, even if it looks, as you say, very infrequent. It's one of the rare case where we have a window on the past and a nice window for dissecting the tissues.
Now that we've established how plants and fungi came onto land and what they're looking like, have there been any symbionts of particular note? Anything that's really spectacular and different to what we know?
Okay, so I pretty well see what you mean.
Yeah.
There's a couple of enigmatic fossils at that time that are very difficult to classify, such as Spongiophyton or Tataxia, which people tend to consider as a kind of moss, but it's not very sure. One of the most fascinating one is probably Prototaxites. Not only it's fascinating, but it seems to have been pretty common there. A Prototaxites, well, when Davison described this in the late 19th century, he was thinking of an ancestor of Taxites, like Taxus, you know, kind of pro-Gymnosperm. Of course, this Prototaxites that arose from the Ordovician on and went extinct in the early Devonian, they are not related to conifers. When I was a student, there was a book of paleontology that mentioned the Prototaxites under the name Nematophytes, which is also sometimes given to that. And they say, well, it's brown algae or green algae. That was one of the interpretations. But listen, what I will describe has nothing to do with algae at all. They are columnar, and those columns, they can be up to 8-10 meters high. They tend to enlarge at the bases, and there is evidence that they are connected to some kinds of rooting system. At least there was description by Jan Edwards of buried rooting systems whose shape is fitting that of the erected column. But we don't know them directly in place and directly connected to that. They very often are fossilized in deltaic or aquatic environments where they clearly have been transferred to. What was not clear and is increasingly clear is that those very damaged fossil did not show us at the beginning that they were probably ramified and that they even had scales. What I mean of scales is big scales at the size of those trunk-like structures. And what they are is very unclear, not only because this shape is not fitting anything we know. So at the time, there were things that were tree-like, you know. But also when you look inside, it's very bizarre. There are concentric rings, so that may be because of growth, okay, growth rings. They are able to embed, to incorporate things from around, piece of rocks, even plants that are growing around, that become encrusted in it. So, like sometimes some fruit bodies of mushrooms growing on dead wood that can, you know, take in their growth everything around, like pieces of grass or trees. And when you look at the microscope, it's made of filaments. There are big tubes, up to 100 micrometers inside, with thick walls, and smaller tubes, septate. That was making the suggestion to Huber in the early 2000s that it could be a fungal organism. He was even thinking that it would be the fruit body, so the organ for spore production of fungi. But he didn't have the spores. He made a lot of extrapolation, and I think that the most important take-home message of his work is that the fungal affinity should be concerned. But can you imagine with biofilms or small lichens or small land plant around up to 20, 30 centimeters, can you imagine enough organic matter to feed a fungus? His idea was a fungus, a saprotrophic fungus. So I and others had the idea that to account for this size, to account for some molecular fossils that were suggesting rather an affinity for green algae or something like that, but also to account for the fact that they went extinct when the first trees belonging to the current land plants arose, ferns or Lycophyta arose. Then the Prototaxites went extinct, which suggested that they were probably photosynthetic. That would allow them to build this enormous shape. That would explain why they went extinct when the first tree arose, just by competition. And that would explain that some molecular fossil you find in that are of algal affinity. And what we suggested is that they were giant lichens. With the bigger tubes, or something still undescribed being the algae, and the finer tubes, the filaments, being simply fungal hyphae. What fungus, what algae, we don't know. For the fungus, there was speculation that they could belong to the same group as, that's a story by, an idea by Greg Retallack, that it could be the same group of fungus as the one making the mycorrhizae on one plant, but we're not sure. Honestly, this is very speculative. And it's funny to imagine that we have here something which is probably fully extinct. It has no current equivalent. If you think of that, in the land flora, it's not so common because most groups, they somehow have some surviving lineage up to now. Well, there are some extinct ones, but they are not so different. For us, it's a bit like some lineages from the Burgess fauna.
Mm.
Something which is fully different and probably without close living relatives. And it may be a symbiosis as well.
It's quite impressive to think of this, what is it, 30-foot lichen when everything else is just a little mat or...
Yeah, or a small, yeah, a suit cover.
It must have been a pretty alien landscape. And do you get many of these Prototaxites fossils? And what were they around in every single environment?
They probably were worldwide. The fossils are not so rare. there are big ones to be seen in the in New York, for example, in the Natural History Museum, in the collections, I mean. Because they are not very much shown to the public, they are not so nice looking. So they were probably everywhere, and they are quite easy to find. And one big question for me is that there are also small things which are not trunk-like and which have the same internal shape. And my big question is whether those things are, they receive different names, of course. But exactly as there was different names for the different parts of the Lycophyta later in the geological record, we gave name to the roots, to the trunk or to the leaves, and before we went aware that they were connected. My question is whether the small things which have the same internal structures as Prototaxites could be simply the scales or appendages on the trunk-like structures. But yes, we have from many places and from many sizes remains that have the same internal structure, these filamentous, with different kind of filaments structure, yes.
If they are photosynthetic, then it would make sense for them to try and enlarge their surface area. I remember like the reconstructions of Prototaxites, and it's just a large column. But if it had these little projections coming off of it, then that would increase its surface area by quite a lot. Do we see any kind of like broken off branches?
There is few fossil where there is an evidence of ramification. Yes. And what I suspect is that when you have the trunks, we have only the lower parts of the story, and the branching part is probably higher than what we get, but was destroyed during the transfer to the place where it finally went fossilized. But you're fully right. I mean, the reason why I'm so excited about this ramification, and I should have mentioned it earlier, is that it's an additional evidence that it could have been photosynthetic. And the reconstruction you mentioned, where it's column-like, those are the ones fitting the hypothesis of Huber that it is a fruit body. Then the surface is producing spores. Well, it could be that some scales could increase the surface, by the way. But it's the reconstruction of it like extant Clavaria or Clavaria delphus fungus, which are column-like and produce spores from their surface. Really, I think that what Davison, in his first drawing of Prototaxites, he is the guy who found Prototaxites in the late 19th century, he added some foliage at the top. For him, it was the idea that it was a proto-taxus, kind of primitive conifer. But it seems now that we have evidence that not only there are ramifications, but also scales at the surface of it. But still, we don't have the reproductive part of it.
Do you think you'll get that? Do we have a lot of evidence of huge amounts of spores from this time that you could perhaps assign to Prototaxites?
No, but as a lichen, it may not have reproduced by spores. Some lichens do not produce spores anymore. And no, definitely there is no propagules or no reproducing things we could link to them. I know that there are some works ongoing on bizarre structures that can be found within this Prototaxites and that might be reproduction structures. So maybe we will know soon more. But honestly, I think we have just a kind of raw backbone when we think of the trunk, and that the interesting parts may already have been described as something else. The interesting parts in terms of reproduction. Keep in mind that also we still don't have the firm evidence that there are algae in it. I mean, there is speculation about some structures, but we have no definite evidence for the story that I'm criticizing my own hypothesis here. But we still have, no good in my eyes evidence of algae there.
Well, that would be a smoking gun for photosynthesis if you could find the algae. So maybe in the future?
Yeah. I'm not directly involved in the research on that. I'm just, as a mycologist, I felt something when while looking at it, but So I flew that from very close and hope that I'm pretty sure from what I know from what Jan Edwards or Christine Struderien are currently making in Paris and London that there would be more soon. What? It looks bizarre as well, but have a look on Prototype Cetus and Nematophytes. There will be more soon.
Okay. It's a shame that these, you say like in, they have specimens in the museum in New York that are just in the collections and not on display. I think this is a really, really interesting fossil, and it's a shame that they don't put it out to the public.
Some people made a bit of fun or outreach on that, but they are not very well known, and honestly, the remains don't look very nice, you know. So for display, it's not outstanding. But there is another caveat here. As you heard from myself, we don't know exactly what it is. So what to show to people? Well, that's the usual trick, that when you display science, you display answers. Mm. That's not very exact, because science is made of questions. But enigmatic fossils, you prefer having more on their biology before showing them to people. That's it.
Do you get any say of what gets displayed in Paris?
No, I would like it to be displayed, but we don't have, dare I say it, we don't have very nice fossils.
Mm. Have you got no prototaxites that you could dry off in the basement from all the flood water and stick out on display?
So you can also make reconstitutions, and I hope that once we will be able to provide somewhere in any natural history museum a kind of environment like the Devonian one, or like the another issue is that we could try to incorporate it in virtual systems for people to walk in the Devonian or walk in the Silurian and see them. But we need first to give them a color, green or not, and a shape, with or without scales. But you know, I often say that I could give months of my life to spend 10 minutes in the Silurian with boots and a knife, because I don't know what is running there around. Because, you know, that's the other thing. As soon as there were enough organic matter on the soil, more than crust, to support the needs of bigger heterotrophs, there started to be animals. And one of the consequences of the story of the development of bigger plants on land is that there started to be animals on land, and big animals. So if you think of it, the story we are discussing was the beginning of fire, the beginning of animal on land, the beginning of more and more photosynthesis and less CO2 in the atmosphere. That was a founding event. And when you think of it, it was pending since years, because the ozone layer was there since probably at least 600 million years ago. Simply, it had to wait for the fungus and the plant to interact.
And so that interaction has really shaped the rest of the course of life on Earth.
Yeah, because, you know, no one was very well made to live in this two-compartment system. When they joined together, the fungus was very prepared with its filaments to explore the soil and to take the water and mineral nutrients. The algae was already preadapted to collect in fluid, water or air, to collect light, gas. So they both were able to do their job, but half of the job. So when they were able to join, they increased the efficiency. And later on, the plant even increased the interaction with the fungus by creating specific organs, the roots, which are often known as nutrition organs, and they are. But they were mainly, from what we understand at the beginning, organs for interaction with the nutritive fungus, the nutrient-providing fungus. And then later on, those roots, they became, in some groups, the place for an autonomous nutrition, But whatever the story, you had slightly the development of an increased exploitation of the ground by fungus and then by rotten fungus.
So if we bring all of this back into the modern day, can we use this understanding of the interaction between plants and fungi to assist in agriculture going forward? I mean, you mentioned how when people tried to move pines into the tropical climates that it didn't work, and that was because of the fungus. Can we do something to make plants grow better in different environments?
You're right asking this question, because nowadays we have an agriculture that is based on the idea that you directly feed the plant. You give a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium, and you expect the plant to be able to take up that. You don't use the fungus. Whereas for most plants, it's for 400 million years of symbiotic nutrition. So nowadays we see the limits of bringing nutrients to the plant, because most of those nutrients, they are leaking into the water. We also foresee that there will be problem with the providing of phosphorus because of limited resources. We also know that producing the nitrogen fertilizers from the atmosphere is very energy consuming. So we have many concerns about the sustainability of what we've done. This classical agriculture was feeding a lot of people, and we have to acknowledge that it was a solution to get more biomass. But nowadays, we may imagine another agriculture that would be able to use a low level of fertilizers by way of increased efficiency of use of the fungus. It's not for now. I'm afraid even that most of the varieties we use now have not been selected anymore to use the fungus. So some of them are under-efficient at responding to a fungus because they were simply selected in the framework of a high-fertility soil. It's a very exciting idea that belongs to this vast cosm of ecological intensification, that is, reusing what is known from the ecological functioning of ecosystems to intensify agriculture, to intensify production. That's one of the very exciting branch of ecological intensification, to use mycorrhizal fungi better in the future, to manage them or to inoculate them, to allow plants to feed better in low fertility environments. And there is more. We know that those fungi, they are also very active in enhancing the plant, the way plants are defending themselves. They have a positive impact on plant defenses, even above ground. Those fungi, they are underground, okay? So, if we have more of those fungi, we also have a benefit in terms of plants' health. If you follow me, it means that by feeding directly the plant and reducing the interaction with the fungus, we make the plant more prone to diseases. So really, there is a room for improvement, you're right. First, it's a room for research, I'm afraid.
So is this known by plant physiologists and by the government that this is what they should be looking at?
Or what they could be looking at, okay? Not enough, I think, because we used to be trained with plants that were self-supporting, like those Brassicaceae, Arabidopsis thaliana, the famous plant model is not mycorrhizal. So we all have this idea of plant exploiting themselves, the soil. It's changing. It's changing because nowadays people are more and more, when they investigate fungal genomes, when they investigate plant genomes, they are more and more looking at all the genetic architecture for the interaction, and they tend to consider more and more the plants having symbionts or the fungi in relation to plants. That's one thing. But the second thing is that to be sure that in the future it will be done, we have to teach more this interaction. We have to teach more that, as many organisms, plants are not autonomous. They rely on interactions. And by telling that to the next generation, I'm pretty sure it would be used as a tool. It will be explored as a possible way of managing ecosystems.
So I think then, just to round off, we should, next time we're all in the supermarket walking around, just consider that everything that you see available there is made possible by the symbiotic relationship of plants and fungi, apart from cabbages.
Yeah, exactly. We have to be grateful to fungi, you're right.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.